Tedros said, remembering his own time as a girl named Essa. All of a sudden he was craving his favourite hot cocoa and wished he hadn't dumped out his mug. Why did he always act first and think later? He tried to catch Agatha's eye, wanting to somehow start a conversation, but he'd ignored her too long, and now she was ignoring him. Merlin, if you were touring other kingdoms, surely you saw some of our classmates on their quests? The princess asked.
Indeed,
the wizard said, finally acknowledging her. Tedros's face fell. And have they, you know, heard about me? The wizard paused.
Let's just say you're not the only one encountering obstacles on their quest.
Huh? But I'm not even on a quest, said Tedros.
Every fourth year ever or never from the School for Good and Evil is on a quest, Tedros,
the wizard corrected.
A quest to discover if they have the strength, wit, and will to become a legend and have their name remembered for all time. It's just your classmates' quests for glory took them to faraway lands, while yours brought you back home.
Doesn't feel like much of a quest to me, Tedros murmured. I'm supposed to be king. It's what I was born to do. Merlin peered at him as if he'd missed the point entirely.
You may have been born to do it, but that doesn't mean you'll do it well.
Tedros said nothing, two hot spots appearing on his cheeks.
Tedros, have you thought about why your father's sword is stuck in the stone?
Merlin asked.
Well, at first I thought it was caught at the wrong angle. Then I thought maybe there was a riddle or a game that if I solved, the sword would pull loose.
That was my theory too, said Agatha. Tedros looked at her, wondering why she hadn't said something to him before, only to realize he'd never given her the chance.
And now? Asked Merlin.
I'm back to thinking it's caught at the wrong angle. Tedros sighed.
What if we consider it from Excalibur's point of view?
Merlin asked. You think Excalibur doesn't want me to pull it out? Tedros asked, surprised.
More like, it doesn't want you to be king, said Merlin.
But I am king.
Only because someone else who has a rightful claim to the throne has yet to pull the sword, and no one does, since you are King Arthur's only child. So again, why won't Excalibur let you complete your father's test?
Tedros crossed his arms.
How should I know what a sword thinks? Excalibur is a weapon of immense power forged by the Lady of the Lake to fight evil. It does not want to spend its days trapped in a balcony,
said Merlin.
Perhaps the sword is trying to be sure you are ready to be king and is waiting for you to prove it. In which case, the question is, how?
Merlin wiped his spectacles with his robes, making them even dustier.
That's theory number one.
And theory number two? Agatha asked.
That it isn't the sword making these decisions at all, said Merlin. That someone else has found a way to control it. Like a master controls a puppet, preventing you from sealing your own coronation, in which case the question is, who?
But no one is powerful enough to control Excalibur, Agatha rebutted. She slowly turned to Tedros. Unless...
No way. The schoolmaster is dead, Tedros scoffed.
Like, forever dead,
Agatha agreed. Like, really forever dead, said Tedros.
They goggled at each other, then back at Merlin. Right?
These are the same questions I have, said the wizard, looking troubled. But it is up to Tedros to find the answers, since it is his test. The sooner he retrieves his sword and seals his coronation, the better. Not just for Camelot, but for the sake of the entire woods.
Entire woods, said Tedros. What do you mean? Are you talking about the attacks in the papers, Merlin? Agatha cut in. I've been reading about problems in Ever and Never Kingdoms. Pirate raids in Jaunt Jolie. A poisoned wishing well in Bremen. A band of werewolves looting families in Bloodbrook. But none of it seems connected.
It isn't. Just a bunch of petty crime, said Tedros. Leaders of neighboring kingdoms think it's more than that, but they just want Camelot to come in and clean up their problems like Dad used to. We have our own problems, thank you. But kings and queens keep writing me letters, demanding meetings.
Which you clearly haven't answered, said Agatha. I heard two chambermaids whispering about why you haven't investigated the fire on Glass Mountain. Tedros turned to Merlin quickly.
Well, are the attacks connected? You said our classmates are having trouble on their quests. What's happening out there in the woods?
Are they okay? Agatha pressed.
Dear girl, maybe you'd know the answer to that if you'd been answering your letters, the wizard replied. Your best friends included.
Tedros looked at Agatha dumbfounded.
You haven't written Sophie.
Agatha's big brown eyes turned wet.
But why?
Tedros blurted against all better judgment.
I'm happily rid of that girl, but you two have so much history. You can't just cut her off.
She seems so excited about the wedding.
And you don't, said Agatha, choking up. Any time I tried to write her, all I could picture is me walking down the aisle to a boy I used to share everything with, and now acts as if he barely knows me. But Sophie knows me. She'd see through anything I wrote. She'd see how I was feeling. And I didn't want anyone to know.
She covered her face, muffling her sobs. Tedros looked at Merlin, sitting between him and his future queen.
Do you mind if I talk to Agatha alone? Thought you'd never ask. Even wizards need the toilet.
Merlin breezed.
Just jump off when you're finished, and you'll find yourselves back where you started.
He snatched his sleeping hat, which startled awake, spurting rainbow sprinkles before the wizard dove off the cloud like a champion swimmer and vanished into the darkness. Tedros scooted across the cloud, silky white fibers tickling his legs as he moved next to Agatha, who was crying into her palms. Gently, he put his hand on her back.
I love you, Agatha. No matter how stupid I can be, nothing will ever change that.
I could only bring myself to write one letter. To Hester. And it was full of lies. I couldn't let anyone know how you were treating me.
Agatha sniffled.
That's why I didn't write anyone else or ask about their quests. 6 months. You made me feel so alone.
I didn't want you to worry about me. Tedros said guiltily.
You made me worry more.
I told you I was stupid.
Stupider than a tree stump,
Agatha piled on. Stupider than a tree stump, Tedros conceded.
Stupider than one of Rafal's zombie villains with no brains.
I don't know if I'd go that.
It wasn't a question.
Tedros smiled and rolled back his eyes zombie style, playfully sinking his teeth into her neck. Agatha yelped and shoved him away, but she was snickering now too. She leaned against him and clasped his arm.
You know, I'm surprised Sophie's still alive, let alone writing you letters, Tedros said. Figured Dovey would have turned her into a pumpkin by now.
Not sure fairy godmothers are allowed to be evil, said Agatha.
But wouldn't it be awesome if they could?
Agatha laughed, that hissy, throaty laugh he'd missed for so long. He pulled her in closer.
Though from Sophie's letters, it sounds like Dovey is out of sorts, said Agatha. She insists it's because Dovey's threatened by her. Sophie claims she's turned evil into the hot new thing, and now all the first-year Evers want to go to her side.
But you think it's something more sinister?
I'm sure Dovey wouldn't mind if a stimpf dropped Sophie on her head, but I doubt she'd get too worked up over a former student's theatrics. Plus, you heard what Merlin said. If our classmates are having trouble on their quests, Dovey has her hands full. The deans are responsible for all fourth years once they leave for their missions, especially with no new schoolmaster in place.
Wouldn't Sophie have mentioned something in her letters? She's dean too.
It doesn't make sense, does it? Agatha agreed. What do you think is happening out there that has Dovey stressed?
And Merlin worried, said Tedros.
And why would it be connected to you not pulling your dad's sword? Said Agatha.
Tedros glanced away, tensing, and he could feel Agatha tighten too, knowing she'd said the wrong thing. He didn't want to talk about the sword with her. Not just because it made him feel inadequate, but because he didn't want her pity.
I'm still imagining what Lance would look like if Merlin turned him into a girl, said Agatha, mercifully changing the subject.
No way Merlin would go for it, said Tedros. Lance would make such a beastly female that it would only call attention to itself.
You were a pretty beastly female yourself, Essa.
Wasn't I the one who had boys whistling at me in the halls?
Boys who like their girls hulking, hairy and belligerent.
Now you're just jealous.
Well, if you want to be a girl so badly, maybe you should plan the wedding, Agatha teased.
Honestly, I found it sexist too at first. The new king focuses on governance, his princess on the wedding, said Tedros. But the more I thought about it, the more I realized traditions exist for a reason. I grew up in Camelot. The people have known me since I was a baby. You, on the other hand, are brand new to them. The kingdom knows nothing about you. Planning the wedding is your coronation test. And I want to pass it with flying colours, not for me, but for the both of us, Agatha said earnestly. But I'd rather be helping you. Tedros exhaled.
Help me manage our debts to other kingdoms that will take centuries to repay. Or help me find out where all Camelot's gold went when the three advisers who handled this gold refused to speak to me. Or help me fight rampant thieving by the poor, even though it helps them survive. Which would you like to help me with?
All of it. Any of it, Agatha said. I know how hard it is.
No, you don't, he said. You can't know how hard it is to watch your father's kingdom turn its back on good.
Just like you can't know how hard it is to watch your one true love turn his back on you, said Agatha. Tedros didn't argue. Finally, he looked at her, tears gleaming.
You really want to help me, Agatha? Then tell me how to pull my sword out of that stone. Tell me how to pass my father's test.
He wiped his nose.
Why do you think I've been avoiding you? I knew this would happen. I knew I'd break down and ask you for help. Can't even finish my coronation on my own. Maybe Merlin's right. Maybe the sword doesn't want me to be king.
He slouched into a sealed-off ball.
Not now. Not ever.
He felt Agatha's hand slide across his back and wrap him into her. She tipped his face upwards. Who says a good king can't get help when he needs it most? His eyes met hers, and a wall inside him crumbled, feelings rushing through. How had he gone this long without coming to her? She, the only person who ever truly understood him.
I can see him looking at me in my dreams. My father, said Tedros, staring at me as if he knows why I failed. He's part of this, and I don't know how.
Agatha wasn't listening. She was deep in thought, already pouncing on his ask for help. Let's be smart about this, she said. Merlin had two theories. Either the sword wants you to prove you're king, or the sword is being controlled by someone who doesn't want you to be king. In any case, grabbing at the sword day after day isn't going to get us anywhere.
But loafing around on a cloud isn't going to solve the problem either, he said, sitting up.
You're forgetting the most important thing Merlin said. He said it isn't only our quest that's run into trouble. It's our whole class.
That would explain all those strange attacks in the woods, said Tedros. So you think whoever is messing up their quests is messing up ours, too?
Maybe Merlin's two theories are actually one. Agatha nodded. The King of Camelot is supposed to be the leader of the woods. If something evil is happening out there, you have to go and find it. You have to figure out what, or who, is disrupting our missions and set things right again. Maybe then you'll be able to pull the sword loose. Maybe that's your real quest. Tedros's face glowed with hope, then dimmed.
Agatha, a king can't just desert his people and go questing in the woods, not when they already doubt me. Who knows how long I'd be out there? Look what became of this place while I was gone at school. Total chaos. Even if my reign has begun badly, if something happened to me, Camelot would end up in the wrong hands again. Maybe forever this time.
He shook his head.
I can't go.
But I can. Agatha jumped in, as if she'd known this would be their conclusion.
Agatha, I asked you for help, not to take over my test, said Tedros impatiently. You heard Merlin. This isn't your quest, it's mine.
And my quest is to be your queen. Helping seal your place as king is more worthy of a queen's attention than picking frosting for our cake. All I need is a few nights for the journey. Chaddick'll be back any day with a new fleet for your round table.
He hasn't answered my letters in weeks, Tedros said.
Then his face changed.
You don't think something went wrong on his quest, too?
Even more reason for me to go, then, and to go right away, Agatha replied. I need to find out what's stopping all of us from fulfilling our missions, good and evil. This is as much my test as it is yours, Tedros. You're not in this alone any more. Tedros saw the steely resolve in her big brown eyes, and suddenly he knew that if he didn't let her go, she would go on her own.
I shouldn't have asked you to butt in, he muttered.
We're going to be married soon, Tedros, Agatha reminded him. I'm supposed to butt in. Tedros said nothing, picking at his shorts.
So, how long would you be gone?
A few weeks. I'll send you letters each night.
A few weeks in the woods, alone.
But I'd see all our friends again, Agatha pressured. And it would mean I can get away from Lady Gremlane.
Tedros bit his lip, as if he couldn't deny her such a pleasure. Even so, it's too dangerous, he said, shaking his head.
I survived Urich. I can survive anything.
Tedros grimaced at the name of Lady Lesso's sadistic son. Questing in the woods alone is a death sentence, Agatha.
Then I'll take someone with me, like Willem.
Willem? The altar boy? He can't even look me in the eye, let alone fight.
Do you make it a habit of looking altar boys in the eye?
All I'm saying is
the matter's settled. I'll leave tonight, Agatha declared. And I suspect that's what Merlin wanted all along, because he dropped a clear hint of how I could escape the castle without anyone knowing.
Baffled, Tedros started to ask what this was, but Agatha added,
The only question is, who will take over wedding planning?
She looked at him hopefully.
You're joking, said Tedros. I have enough on my plate, thank you.
I could hire someone.
With what money?
Someone who would do it as a favor to the kingdom.
And this someone would have good taste, be as invested in the wedding as you and me, manage all facets of a royal occasion that has to go off without a hitch, and also work for free?
Said Tedros incredulously.
I should think so.
It will take months of searching to find such a person, Agatha, if such a person even exists.
Not really.
Tedros cocked his head.
You have someone in mind.
Do you trust me?
Agatha asked, eyes twinkling.
You know I do.
And I can pick anyone I choose?
Of course. You'll be queen soon.
Then promise me this is my choice and no one else's.
I promise, but honestly...
Good, said Agatha, climbing into his lap. Then I'll pay her a visit on my first stop into the woods.
Tedros peered at her, mystified.
pay who a visit? Who's she?
He choked.
Have you lost your damned mind?
You said it yourself, we can't just cut her off, Agatha replied, hands sliding up his chest.
Not we, you, Tedros shouted. You think I'll let her plan our wedding? I'd rather eat glass for a month. I'd rather drown myself in hot lava. No, 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 no!
But now she was clasping his cheeks and kissing him, long and slow. And it had been so long since she'd kissed him that suddenly he could think of nothing else, only her soft lips on his and his beautiful, brilliant bride-to-be. I love you, Tedros, she whispered.
And I love you, too, he breathed. But no.
If only a king's promise wasn't stronger than a prince's, she said, smiling like a cat.
A promise doesn't count if you tricked me.
And does that mean your trust doesn't count either? Agatha asked intently. Tedros gawped at her, knowing he'd been beaten.
But...
He barked with frustration and kissed her again, hard and deep, because he couldn't possibly think about everything he'd just agreed to. He kissed her so long they ran out of air, until Agatha pulled him backwards, dragging him off their perch, and they fell through clouds, the two of them still kissing, tangled in each other's limbs like interlocked stars. Chapter 7. Chadic, the Liege and the Lady. He had been stabbed twice in the back and once in the flank, but he was still alive. Concealed behind a white wall, Chadic listened for his attacker, but all he heard was a faint crashing of waves. Blood leaked through his shirt, into his lap. He felt no pain, just cold, prickly shock. It had happened so fast. 5 minutes ago he'd been riding his horse on the snowy shores of Avalon, searching for the entrance to the Lady of the Lake's castle. He'd bought a map of the island from a nosy beaver, but the map only seemed to take him round in circles. At last, when he was frostbitten and ready to give up, he'd found it. Towering iron doors as high as a mountain, guarded by two stone lions, concealed in shadow on either side. He didn't expect the gates to open for him. They opened for no man, except Merlin and the King of Camelot. The stone lions would devour anyone else who tried to enter. But Chadic hadn't come to enter the gates. He'd travelled long and hard across the woods for only one reason, to make sure that these doors were still sealed tight, that no one had breached the Lady of the Lake's realm, that his fears were unfounded. But as he'd approached, he'd seen his fears had come true. The doors weren't sealed. One was hanging off its hinges, the other splintered into pieces. Who could splinter iron? He'd gazed at the stone lions, motionless and piled with weeks of snow. If someone had broken in recently, they'd done so untouched. Why would the lions let an intruder through? Moving quicker, Chadic had dug an iron shard into the snow and tied his horse to it before he'd cautiously stepped between the lions and onto castle grounds, scanning the towers and cliff rock for signs of evil. His attacker had come from behind. Chadic had tried to turn, but his assailant jammed his cheek to a rock with one hand, the other on the boy's back.
Even in his wrestling matches against Tedros, Chadwick had never felt such strength.
"Who are you?"
Chadwick had choked, but his attacker just hissed in his ear. Dead calm, he'd slipped Chadwick's sword out of his belt and stabbed him in the back while Chadwick screamed with pain. As he'd stabbed again, Chadwick kicked with primal instinct, his boot connecting with bone. His attacker buckled, and Chadwick broke free, limping past Avalon's towers until he'd found a place to hide. It had all happened in 5 minutes. Now he waited behind that white wall, listening to the echo of waves, stab wounds soaking his shirt red. Panic set in. His muscles slacking, he was losing too much blood. Chadwick tensed. Footsteps. Coming down the path. Crackle, crackle, crackle. Against the snow. They stopped. Chadwick held his breath. He squinted up at the circle of pearl-white towers, coated in snow, for it was always winter in Avalon. The towers had no windows or doors to sneak through. The best he could do was dart from wall to wall like a hunted deer. Rising from his crouch, he saw zigzagging staircases ahead, leading from the towers down to a calm lake. He had to get to the water. The Lady of the Lake would hide him, just like she'd done for Guinevere and Lancelot. Run for it? He'd be in the open for his attacker to spot him. The stairs were slick with snow, his bloody shirt would be like a flag to a bull, and he didn't have his sword. Chadwick stripped off his shirt. The frigid air flayed his skin as he tried to wipe clean, but the gash in his ribs kept gushing, and he didn't even know where the blood on his back was coming from. Shock wore off, giving way to soul-crushing pain. Hands shaking, he scraped snow off the ground and packed it into the wounds to staunch them. It didn't work. Pain throttled from every direction now. He couldn't breathe. Crackle, crackle, crackle. The killer was coming. Without thinking, Chadwick darted from his hiding spot and sprinted to the next tower, diving behind its wall. For a moment, there was silence. Then a soft, hissy laugh. Crackle. Tears stung Chadwick's eyes. 2 weeks earlier, he'd sent Dovey a note by crow. He'd been seeing strange things in the woods. Ever and never kingdoms attacked. Unrest and fear spreading everywhere. Classmates' quests sabotaged. Something was happening. He knew he was supposed to be collecting knights for Camelot, but he was Tedros's liege and a knight himself. If he could find out why things were going wrong in the woods, maybe he could find out why Tedros's sword had gotten stuck too. Maybe he could help Tedros free Excalibur and seal his crown. Tedros would be so grateful to him. It would be Chadwick's first step to becoming a legendary knight, as precious to Tedros as Lancelot once was to Arthur. Well, until a girl had come between them. He'd be better than Lancelot then. Except Dovey had appeared via her crystal ball.
"I received your note, Chadwick, and I see from my quest map you're already deviating from your quest without my permission,"
she declared through a wobbly bubble in the sky.
"Go back to your quest. Do you understand? Leave the rest to me and Merlin."
Chadwick had ignored her. It didn't matter that Dovey had assigned his quest. A knight's first loyalty is to his king.
That's why he'd spent the last 2 weeks following clues in the woods. That's how he came to discover everything. It was all connected. Tedros's trapped sword, his friend's failed quests, the attacks. It was all the work of a new villain, more powerful than the schoolmaster, more powerful than anything their world had ever seen. Each new attack was part of a bigger plan. A plan to destroy Camelot and its king, a plan to take down good and evil, a plan to rule the endless woods. Chadwick heard footsteps get closer. He'd tracked this villain all the way to Avalon. He thought he could vanquish him on his own like a real knight. He didn't know the villain was tracking him, too. Chadwick wiped his eyes. He couldn't go down like this. Not when his friends needed him. Not without a fight. He focused on his fear. His loyalty to Tedros. His love for his fellow evers and nevers. His fingertip glowed silver. Now! He leapt out of his hiding spot to face his attacker and shot him with a stun spell, not waiting to see if it hit before he dashed for a staircase 30 feet away. Chadwick hurtled down the steps towards the lake, slipping on snow and tumbling to the next landing, almost knocking himself out. Bleary with pain, he could hear his attacker's hissy laughter, his footsteps descending the stairs. Wheezing, Chadwick lurched to his feet, leaving a smear of blood in the snow, and continued to limp down. The lake. I have to make it to the lake. He staggered off the last steps and slid through icy mud on the shore. I need the Lady of the Lake. He choked, dripping blood. The clear grey surface stayed still. He looked back and saw a shadow moving down the stairs, in no hurry at all. Chadwick swiveled to the water. I'm Camelot's knight! Now the lake changed. It spun into a whirlpool, mirroring the circle of towers above. The waters churned faster, faster, so fast that a thick foam spewed from the pool's eye, coalescing into human shape. A ghostly silver-haired nymph in white robes floated out of the lake. She had pale skin, a long nose, and big black eyes that honed in on Chadwick. Smiling with relief, he rushed towards the water, but the instant his foot touched it, it repelled him, flinging him to the ground. The Lady of the Lake's expression didn't change. "What are you waiting for?" he cried. "You have to protect me!" "I protect those most loyal to Camelot," the Lady of the Lake replied. "I am loyal! I'm Tedros's liege!" Again he crawled for the water. Again it repelled him. What are you doing?" he gasped. But the Lady of the Lake wasn't looking at him now. She was looking past him. Slowly Chadwick turned to see his assailant coming off the stairs, dressed in black, his face covered by a scaly green mask. He was holding Chadwick's sword, coated with Chadwick's blood. Chadwick dropped to his knees and clasped his hands towards the nymph. "Don't you see? He's going to kill me! Help! Please!" But she didn't. Instead, she did something that made Chadwick sick. She looked back into the eyes of his green-masked killer and smiled. Chapter 8. Sophie. One quest to save them all.
Where is the cake, Bogdan? Where are the gift bags? Where is the bouquet? Sophie berated, barreling towards Evil Hall in her white taffeta gown, crystal tiara, and spiked silver heels.
You need those things for a school dance?
Bogdan asked, holding her train and stumbling behind. All Tedros had to do to seal his reign was host a coronation, and now look where he is. You know why kingdoms fall, Bogdan? Because of bad parties. Sophie flared. How long until the doors open?
5 minutes. The welcome committee is almost done decorating.
Why don't I hear music then? Why don't I smell cucumber and dill butter canapes? Bogdan gaped at her. Were you taking notes when we went over this? Sophie squawked, trundling towards the ballroom. No wonder you failed all your classes.
Dean Sophie, I've been knocking on your bathroom door for 5 hours to ask questions.
As if anyone has time for questions. First Gavaldon girl caves in a classroom, and now you with your questions. Why did I bring readers into this school at all? Sophie moaned. This is the first time a dean has ever thrown an evil party. The first time the Evers will see our castle, and the first time Clarissa Dovey will realize there's no need for a new schoolmaster when the students already follow me. I've even invited the Royal Rot, in case they want to write a story about Tedros's former flame, moved on to a life of staggering success and fawning fans, unlike her once prince and now maligned king. She flung open the doors to Evil Hall with a dramatic flourish. The ballroom was lit dungeon brown by 2 dying torches. The 6 first-year Nevers of the Welcome Committee beamed proudly at her as they hung wispy tinsel and laid out a cloudy punch bowl on a crooked wooden table, along with a hunk of misshapen cheese. In the center of the room, under a dented mirror ball, 2 bats perched on top of Sophie's statue, swiping and eating circling moths attracted by the weak, pulsing lights. A banner drooped between 2 walls, "Dean Sophie welcomes you," with the U looking more like a V, since the painters had started their letters too big and run out of space. A wolf slumped on the floor beneath the banner, burping loudly and playing a dirge on a broken violin. Sophie clutched her throat. "It's like one of Honora's garden parties," she whirled to Bogdan. "Where's Hort?"
"Professor Hort said if he can't be your date, he's not coming."
Sophie curled her fists. That whiny, mangy rodent! Through the window she saw the lights of fairies leading the Evers through Good's glass castle towards Halfway Bridge. "Oh, I try to empower you fools like I'm supposed to, and make you feel supported and involved and appreciated," Sophie seethed, shaking her fists. "But if you want something done right, you have to do it yourself." In a flash, she whirled into action, pointing fingers at the welcome committee. "Fatima, fetch an enchanted pot from the kitchen. Barnaby, get a pouch of lizard tongues and a vial of cat tears from Professor Manley. If he won't give them to you, steal them. Vladimir, remember that putrid band you formed?"
"The one you sent us to the doom room for because you said we ruined your beauty sleep,"
he peeped, blinking beneath his unibrow. "It's legal for one night only," Sophie commanded. "Rex, open up the windows. Barty, borrow Professor Sheik's spellbook. The password to her office is Uti Queen. And someone tell Professor Hort if he doesn't get here in the next 10 seconds, I'll tell the whole school their history teacher sleeps with a stuffed turtle." Her finger glowed pink, and she thrust it at the mirror ball, which blinded all of them in an explosion of red. 5 minutes later,
Sophie sat on the shoulders of Hort's giant man-wolf, cheerily greeting awed Evers and Nevers as they came through the doors. Towering 7 feet tall, Hort made sure to roar for each one and beat his hairy chest, while the first years moved into Evil Hall, glittering with magical red and gold fireworks that ripped across the ceiling, spelling, "Night of a Thousand Sophies." On the walls, scarlet shadows played scenes from Sophie's fairy tale, occasionally reaching out to spook passing kids. In the corner, Evers and Nevers filled their cups with sparkly soda from a fountain made out of 200 crystal goblets. The glittering liquid changed colors and flavors every minute. Green apple, golden honey, red raspberry, blue winter mint. Nearby, a horde of kids raided a table with trays that magically replenished with wasabi shrimp, herbed biscuits, persimmon bruschetta, dill-stuffed cucumbers, pork-wrapped mushrooms, baked potato bites, salmon pinwheels, olive crostini, and vanilla sage canapes. But most of the revelers were jam-packed in the center around Sophie's statue, headbanging to Vladimir's band. "Vladimir and the Plague," the drum said, while Good's fairies sprinkled fairy dust on band members, levitating them over the crowd. A few intrepid Nevers scooped fallen fairy dust off the floor and gobbed it under their tongues, sending them shooting across the dance floor like comets, earning raucous cheers. "And they've all dressed for the theme," Sophie marveled, high atop Hort's shoulders, as both Evergirls and Nevergirls thronged in, flaunting Sophie's most famous looks from The Tale of Sophie and Agatha. There was a kimono Sophie with shimmering makeup and ruby red hair, a baby doll Sophie in a black lacy dress and licking a pink lollipop, a no-ball Sophie complete with pink gown, bald cap and stick-on warts, an evil queen Sophie in full black leather and snakeskin cape, a rebel Sophie in a dazzling slit-back black dress with red sequins that spelled F is for fabulous. There were even a few Philips. Not to be left out, several boys had dressed like Tedros, with some in his creamy white breeches and royal blue lace-up shirt from the first year Evers ball, a few in his loose ivory shirt and black pants from his night with Sophie in an Avalon cave, and two tall Never boys who'd worn the tightest of shorts and foregone shirts entirely.
"Hort, darling, there's even one of you," Sophie said, pointing to a bone-thin, rabbit-faced boy in handmade frog pajamas who'd just spilled his drink on a girl.
"Got the pajamas wrong," Hort's man-wolf grumped.
"Oh, don't be a louse. You know they're all having so much fun, I can't tell the Evers from the Nevers anymore," said Sophie, watching more of Good's students flood in with giddy smiles as if they'd secretly been waiting their whole lives for an evil party. "Even the teachers have stopped searching for a reason to shut it down." Professor Manley and Professor Sheeks were snickering as they stealthily shot flames across the soda fountain every time an Ever reached for a glass. Nearby, Castor and Professor Anemone shook their rumps on the dance floor while students of both schools hooted them on.
"Listen, I can't last much longer like this. I'm hot, hairy, and hungry,"
Hort grouched, drool dripping from his snout.
"Any second I'm going to shrink back to human without any clothes on."
"You can't go now. The room 46 boys are almost here," Sophie said, squinting at a pack of Ever boys crossing the bridge. "I knew Bodhi, Lathan, and the rest of their delicious little clan would come, even if they didn't RSVP. Handsome boys never RSVP. They just grace you with their presence like a balmy day in winter."
"What? Who's Bodhi? Who's Lathan?"
Hort growled,
How do you know ever boys' names?
Don't be ridiculous. Everybody knows the boys of Honor Tower, room 46. Besides, I'm sure you can last as a man-wolf for as long as you want. Think of first year, when you could only do it for 5 seconds. Now you can go all night, if you put your mind to it.
I'm not lasting all night for a bunch of ever-boys,
Hort snapped. Don't be irrelevant, darling, Sophie wisped. For 6 months, I've been obsessing over Agatha and Tedros, wondering how they were doing in Camelot. I know I said I hadn't given them the slightest thought, but we both know that's a lie, so I might as well be honest. I couldn't bear the idea that they could be happy without me, even after that hellfire of a coronation. But tonight's the first night I haven't thought of them at all. Which goes to show, if Agatha doesn't want me to help her plan her wedding, then I'll happily throw a party for myself. And I assure you, mine will be far better.
She smiled as the fireworks over the dance floor arranged into a vision of her own face, and students from both schools hollered their approval. Nearby, kids dug into a red velvet cake, shaped as a giant S and flanked by piles of oat ginger cookies frosted with sayings like, S is for sublime, S is for succulent, S is for Sophie. A pimply, sharp-toothed Neverboy climbed her statue and kissed it triumphantly, eliciting whistles and cheers, but Sophie didn't mind it in the least. Soaking in the ever-never chants from the dance floor, Sophie! Sophie! Sophie!
If you think about it, Aggie and I don't even have much in common anymore, Sophie added, waving back at the adoring crowd. She has her life with Tedros, the two of them about to marry and become each other's family. And I have my own life, weddingless, familyless, dateless, but so filled with possibilities.
I thought I was your date, Hort said.
Look at my little peaches. Aren't they scrumptious?
Sophie gushed, nodding at a few awkward never-girls in hip-hugging black leather, talking to a shrimpy ever-boy.
Spent all week teaching them how to fake self-esteem. What do you think? They're all your age. Any of them catch your fancy?
My what? Are you insane? Hort retorted. Not only are they first years, but I'm their teach-
Put me down! Sophie gasped.
What?
Down, Hort! Down!
Hort quickly swung her to the floor, and Sophie lunged in front of him.
Bodie, darling, welcome to my school.
Sophie purred, holding out her hand to a tall, reedy boy in a royal blue coat, with dark caramel skin and big black eyes, who gently took it and kissed it like a prince.
And hello, Lathan. You're looking exceptionally handsome tonight, she said to his short, muscular friend with chestnut hair and freckles.
Lathan smiled flirtily and kissed her on the cheek.
Well, if that's how you're going to say hello, I'll say hello to all of you,
Sophie cooed, presenting her cheek to the rest of their ever-boy gang. Swimmery, silver-haired Akira, dark wavy-haired Valentine, bald-headed, ghostly Devon.
Save a dance for me, she whispered to each one.
A dance? Hort hissed in her ear, apoplectic. You're a dean, not a hostess at the Pig and Pepper. You can't dance with students.
I've combed the Ever-Never Handbook thoroughly and see no rules against it. And besides, some of these boys look far older than I do, Sophie said, turning to greet the next boy.
Only it wasn't a boy at all. It was a dean. And she wasn't alone. Dean Dovey clacked past Sophie into Evil Hall, green gown sweeping behind her, as if this was her school and Sophie the intruder. The silver-haired professor was flanked by three witches, each of who glared at Sophie one by one.
"Ever boys in our castle," said the tattooed witch. "Ever boys in our school," said the albino witch.
"Told you, told you, told you,"
huffed the jolly witch, turning Sophie's tiara into chocolate and gobbling it down in one bite.
"You lied to me,"
Sophie mewled, gaping at Clarissa's quest map floating over the sand on Evil's side of Halfway Bay. All her classmates' names were coloured red beneath their moving figurines instead of blue, like they were on her map.
"But I'm supposed to know everything. I'm a dean. I'm your equal. Instead, you give me a false map. You make me think all our quests are going well. You keep me in the dark on the fact my friends are failing miserably."
"Friends is a loose term," Hester murmured. "And you being equal to Dovey is like Dot being equal to me," said Annadil.
"We'll see who's equal when I turn your rats to fudge," said Dot. "Oh, be quiet, girls," Professor Dovey said, sitting gingerly in one of Evil's cabanas that Sophie had added when she turned the once barren shores of Halfway Bay into a beach. Music and laughter from the party carried down the hill. With the August nights sultry and fresh, the elder dean had recommended they speak outside, where students wouldn't overhear. But now Dovey was peering around at the torchlit huts, decorated with glamorous portraits of Sophie. The golden sand, speckled with S-shaped conches. The once sludgy black moat of Evil turned royal blue, with a statue of Sophie astride a dragon spraying water from its mouth.
"I honestly don't know where I am," she murmured.
Sophie cleared her throat harshly.
"I know you're upset, Sophie, and you have every right to be,"
Professor Dovey sighed, massaging her knees.
"Fairy godmothers don't make it a habit of using magic to deceive. But fairy godmothers also have a duty to protect the greater good. If you'd known what was happening, it was only a matter of time before word of the older students' struggles leaked through the school and distracted the first years. I know you'll say you can keep a secret, but frankly, you seem incapable of setting boundaries with your new charges at the moment."
Sophie put her hands on her hips.
"What in heavens makes you say that?"
Dovey turned towards the castle's open windows. Inside Evil Hall, two Neverboys danced saucily on Sophie's statue, while an Everboy spotted Sophie watching and yelled,
"Dean Sophie, will you marry me?"
Sophie stabbed out her glowing pink finger, shutting the windows and drawing the curtains.
"Well, if you were so scared of telling me about these failing quests, why are you telling me now?"
Professor Dovey turned to her.
"Because I need you to lead a quest into the woods and save your fellow classmates before any more of them die."
Every trace of defiance melted out of Sophie's face. She saw the three witches staring at Good's dean the same way.
"Die?"
Sophie rasped. Professor Dovey looked away, mouth quivering. Sophie could hardly get the word out.
"Who?"
The elder dean watched the waters of the bay roll between Good and Evil, thin to thick, water to slime.
"The map,"
Dovey whispered. Slowly, Sophie and the witches raised their eyes to the dean's quest map. its names in Red Alarm Red so different from the cool, serene blues Sophie had seen across her doctored one. But one name was different. Its ink was darker red than the others, and dripping off its label as if sea